Next time you fill up your gas tank, consider the argument that the gas you're putting into your car might have been stolen.
It's the same as back in the days of the slave trade. You know, people were selling other people as property, and it was taken for granted. It's the way the world had always worked. In our day, the world works in a very strange way that we take for granted. We'll make it legal for us to buy natural resources, essentially from whoever can control them by force.
This is Leif Winar. He's the author of the book Blood Oil, and he argues that drilling for oil, or for that matter, mining and profiting from diamonds or copper or coltan, without the consent of people who live on the land, is theft, and that enabling authoritarians and armed groups to seize and profit from those resources is unethical and unnecessary.
We in North America do not need to buy authoritarian oil anymore. Even as we transition away from fossils, we have enough of our own energy right now. We don't need to send our money to those guys.
This is Whose Century Is It? I'm Mary Kay Magstead. Many of the 20th century's conflicts and politics were drenched in oil. We fought wars, made unsavory alliances, and spent many billions of dollars protecting our access to foreign oil. We needed it for our cars, our flights, our heating, our plastics. And then others around the world saw this modern American way of life looked pretty comfortable, so they started to copy it. And then they needed lots of oil, too. So suddenly there was lots of demand, and countries or groups that were able to sell oil suddenly became very powerful and very rich. I remember, perhaps you do too, the long lines at the pumps in the 1970s because OPEC was putting the squeeze on supply. But that was then. Now, in the 21st century, we have more choices. We have more oil and gas of our own within North America, and we're using less of it. But even now, we still get a lot of our oil and the metals in our mobile phones and other resources from places where authoritarians or armed groups are profiting and ordinary people are suffering. In fact, Leif Winar says, after 10 years of research on this topic, the average American household sends about $275 a year to such people just by filling up at the pump. But it doesn't have to be that way, as you'll hear in this podcast episode. I should mention that Leif Winar's day job is as chair of the Department of Philosophy and Law at King's College in London. His arguments on why we should be more discerning about where we get our oil are both pragmatic and philosophical, and I think pretty interesting. Hope you think so too. Here we go. So your book makes this provocative argument that links ISIS, Al-Qaeda, problems in the Sudan, problems with Saudi Arabia, 9/11, and a whole bunch of other things. And there's one thread that runs through all of these things.
It's oil. And you're absolutely right, Mary Kay. Think about all those places you just mentioned. Think about the worst threats and crises our country has faced in the last 40 years. They all are coming from oil states. All of those threats and crises were funded with oil money, meaning that they were ultimately funded with our money, what we've been paying at the pump for gasoline. And now we're paying for both sides of the war on terror. Of course, we're paying for our own military to go after groups like ISIS in Iraq and Syria and Libya. But we're also sending a huge amount of money to regimes that directly and indirectly fund and encourage these extremists.
So is that a correlation or is it causation or?
It's not an accident that places that export a lot of oil have a lot of problems, which end up spilling back onto us. There's something called the oil curse. Countries that export a lot of oil, especially the ones that are not democratic, have a much higher risk of authoritarianism. They're much more likely to be at war with themselves. They're much more corrupt. They have more poverty. There's some really deep problems.
When you say they're much more likely to be authoritarian, it's by quite a large margin, right?
It is. Countries in the developing world are 50% more likely to be authoritarian, and their chance of civil war is even more than that, 200% more likely. It's because these oil kings can get their source of power directly from the ground. They don't need their people to be educated. They don't need their people to be productive. All they need is for their people to stay away from the holes in the ground where they get their power. As long as they can keep control over those holes in the ground, they get a tremendous amount of money from the world, and they can use that money to buy the muscle and the loyalty they need to stay in power while bathing their own populations in whatever religious ideology they want. And in the Saudi case, spread that ideology also around the world. The power of oil is almost entirely unaccountable, and we, foreigners, can't control it from the outside. That's the big result we should see from the past 40 years. Look at the strategies the West has tried to use to control the power of oil from the outside. Basically, we've tried three different things. First, we've tried to make an alliance with a oil-powered authoritarian. So we tried that with the Shah of Iran. How did that go? We tried it with Saddam. We tried it with Gaddafi. We're still trying it with the Saudis, who are spreading that extreme, intolerant version of Islam around the world. Okay, we have a second strategy. Military action. Gulf War I, Gulf War II, Libya, cover the region with drones. How's that going? All right, we try sanctions. Russia, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Sudan. How are these strategies going? Well, the director of the CIA stood up in front of Congress in March and said, "The Middle East is the worst it's been in 50 years, and the region faces unprecedented bloodshed. The only source of accountability over oil has to be the people of the country itself having minimal accountability over their own government. That's got to be the solution."
And when you say minimal, what do you mean?
Yeah, that's important. All it would mean is that the people need minimal, bare bones, political rights and civil liberties to be able to find out what's happening to their resources. Who's selling off the oil? Who's getting the money from it? Can the people find that out? Can they talk to each other about that? And if a majority of citizens feel strongly that the government's doing the wrong thing with their resources, can they protest and make government policy change?
But this is sort of on a sliding scale, right? So if someone's somewhere in the middle or 40% of the way there, then what happens?
It's a great question. And it's really important for us to be able to draw a bright line about which countries are of accountability and which countries don't, right? And these are big questions, a huge amount of money at stake, investments take a long time. Luckily, we have metrics that measure exactly the kinds of things we're looking for. There's a number of well-established, long-lived metrics that tell us in each country what is the situation with political rights and civil liberties. There's different ones. They tend to say the same thing. Polity has one. The Economist has one. Freedom House has one. We could make a metric of metrics to get extra objectivity and say, look, below this line, the people just could not possibly be authorizing their government to do what it's doing with the natural resources.
You've been working on this for a decade. You're clearly very passionate about it, and you've put a lot of deep thinking into it. What drew you to this topic? Was there an aha moment where you thought, oh my goodness, so much is tied up in this. I need to spend more time thinking about a way out of the many problems that this causes?
Yeah, there was. And it just happened that I went to Nigeria, and I went with friends, and I just started asking about oil. Because I could see this huge country, by far the biggest population in Africa, teeming with young, entrepreneurial, energetic people who wanted a chance to live their dreams, to get ahead, and were thwarted by this incredibly corrupt, violent government, which was just stealing all the oil money and using it for the purposes of the elite. That's when I saw the oil curse, and I saw it firsthand. People living in really desperate poverty, preyed upon by their own police, not provided with electricity, running water, education, even being bulldozed off of their land when some corrupt official wanted to build some new project on it. And then as I kept working, I kept seeing, when we feed misery and oppression overseas, we shouldn't be surprised when that comes and bites us back, as it has again and again, especially from the Middle East. So it's their problem, and it becomes our problem too.
Okay, so if someone listens to that and says, well, all right, and that's bad, but what can I do about that? You know, we need oil. We need to put oil in our cars. As you've said, oil is in so many other things that we use, in our clothes made of synthetic fibers, in our children's plastic toys, in cosmetics. What do you do?
Oil is everywhere. I mean, 95% of the world's transportation right now runs on oil. That's almost every car, truck, plane, boat. The world's fleet is oil-powered, and even as we switch over the fleet, we're going to be using this mud for a long time to come. So we do need oil, especially for transportation energy. But here's the big message. We in North America do not need to buy authoritarian oil anymore. Even as we transition away from fossils, we have enough of our own energy right now. We don't need to send our money to those guys.
So how do you tell where the oil's coming from? Doesn't it all get mixed together in the refineries?
It does, but actually that's the easy part. There used to be a problem not with blood oil, but with blood diamonds, where diamonds were funding these terrible militias, for example, in Sierra Leone. You might have seen that DiCaprio movie, Blood Diamonds.
Sure.
That was a representation of blood diamonds in that terrible civil war. And it was said at the time, look, we can't do anything about that because we can't trace diamonds, right? There's these little things and they get cut and polished. Well, it turns out even for diamonds, we can trace them well enough to put a regime in place where we no longer buy blood diamonds. Oil is a lot easier than diamonds. Oil is big, it's heavy, it's moved around on these gigantic tankers which are kept track of by satellites. We know where the oil is coming from. And as you say, actually, we need to know where the oil is coming from because to refine it correctly, you essentially have to know where it comes from. So in the United States, if you go to the Energy Information Agency website, there's just a big spreadsheet every month that says for every barrel of oil that comes into the country, where was its country of origin? We can track the oil. That's the easy part.
And as an example, you mentioned blood diamonds. There's a very interesting story as to how the United States found the political will to track blood diamonds.
That's right. And this is such an encouraging story, especially for people who think that the system is rigged and we can't do anything, and for idealistic young people who want to change the way the world works at its foundations. So there's this terrible problem of blood diamonds in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And there were a group of idealistic actors who knew that this was a big problem and we needed to put an international regime in place to stop the flow of diamonds from these militias and a consumer's money back to them. And they had a plan, and they knew it was the right plan, a registration scheme, and they put it forward, but it was the late 90s, and we had a lot of else going on, and no one really paid that much attention to them because it was just some crisis in Western Africa. But then blood diamonds were found in possession of Al-Qaeda after 9/11. And that was the window of opportunity.
And why did they have diamonds?
It turns out that diamonds are the best store of value in the world. And Al-Qaeda knew that after 9/11, their bank accounts would be frozen. So they needed some place to put their assets. And they bought these diamonds from these terrible militias in Sierra Leone from the dictator of Liberia, Charles Taylor. And that's how they got their financial assets secured. Once the United States found out that Al-Qaeda was buying blood diamonds, it became a priority one national security problem for the United States of America. 18 months later, the plan of that group of activists was put into effect. The U.S. Congress passed the Clean Diamond Act and led the world to pass similar acts banning the importation of blood diamonds in all major countries. So we've done it for blood diamonds. We could do it for blood oil as well.
For diamonds, for various kinds of rare earths and metals, and for oil. You make a case, a philosophical case, for this being theft, and theft in a way that I think a lot of people who are putting gas in their cars and buying toys that might have indirectly used oil that came from conflict zones, they don't necessarily think of it in these terms.
It's one of these ways the world works that we inherit and we don't think about. It's the same as back in the days of the slave trade. You know, people were selling other people as property, and it was taken for granted. It's the way the world had always worked. In our day, the world works in a very strange way that we take for granted. we'll make it legal for us to buy natural resources, essentially from whoever can control them by force. When those diamonds came from Sierra Leone, those terrible militias that were amputating thousands of people to get control of the diamond fields, well, they went through the world's supply chains, and when they got here to the United States, they were bought legally in diamond rings and earrings. That was a case of might in one country making right here. Sometimes whoever it is that's got the might is in control of a whole country. So, for example, when Gaddafi took over Libya in a coup, the laws of the United States started making it legal to buy Libya's oil from Gaddafi. If you and I went and overthrew the government of Angola tomorrow by force, the next day we would have the legal right to sell Angola's oil to Americans. But that rule makes no sense. This is the thing about our global system, because if you and I went and took control of a gas station down the street by force, no one thinks we should get the legal right to sell off the gas and keep the money. So the obvious rules that work at home are just the rules that we're violating when it comes to the natural resources of other countries.
And weirdly, this applies to ISIS, right? They grabbed territory and now they're selling oil and gas.
That's right. It was legal when ISIS first took over to buy Iraq's oil from ISIS. And it looks like some of ISIS oil did actually get into European markets. Now, we then went and put sanctions on ISIS. But that means that we went against our default rule, which is the default rule of every country in the world. Whoever controls it by force there can sell it to us here and we'll have the legal right to own it.
So at this point, what's happening to ISIS's oil? ISIS's, I'm putting this in quotation marks in the air here. What's happening to the oil that's in the territory that ISIS controls?
Mostly that oil is sold within Iraq. Some of it is sold on to Syria. All major powers now officially have sanctions on ISIS. So it's not legal to buy oil from ISIS anymore, but it's not a big market for them to sell their oil outside of the war zones. Essentially, they're still making their money from selling oil to the people in the conflict itself. We're attacking the oil facilities to try to dry up their sources of revenue, but they're still making a fair amount of money from that oil.
So let's continue with your argument. Quoting philosophers, including John Locke, you say, resources belong to the people. You can either look at that as the resources on Earth belong to all the people on Earth, but then you say, yeah, but it's kind of hard to get people to get behind the idea of having one universal government. So at the very least, if you're going to recognize borders and the resources within them, you also have to recognize that the people who live within those borders, and not just their leaders, particularly if they're not elected leaders, have the right to say what happens to those resources.
That's exactly right, Mary Kay. And it's a principle that our leaders now reflexively say. George W. Bush said, Iraq's oil belongs to the people of Iraq, right? It's also a principle that's embedded in major documents of international law. So, for example, the two major human rights covenants both say in Article 1, all peoples may, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources. The world has already converged on this better, very natural rule that resources ultimately belong to the people. Our challenge now is to switch away from the bad old rule of might makes right to the better modern rule and recognize the ultimate ownership of resources by the people of each country.
Okay, so I'm going to do here what a journalist does, and I'm going to be a little bit of a skeptic. I lived in China for many years, and the Chinese government says it acts on behalf of the people. It is the people's government. But it certainly makes a lot of decisions that I don't think people have actually had much say in saying whether they like it or not. And I also know the Chinese government's response to this argument would be, you know, you can't interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. So how would you persuade the Chinese government or others who need to be persuaded to put the right kind of incentives before the Chinese government that what you're saying has validity and actually is in the best long-term interests of pretty much everyone?
So it is in the best interests of everyone to recognize the people's control over the resources. And the Chinese, who are long-term thinkers in a way that we are not in our governments, should see this.
China was buying its oil from the Sudan, and then the Sudan was using the money it got from China to buy weapons and helicopters from China. And the Chinese government seemed to think that was a perfectly profitable cycle for it to be involved in.
We both saw the big push of China, especially into Africa, in the past 15 years. And a lot of Chinese money went into Africa and a lot of African natural resources went back to China. And the Chinese were making deals with everyone, not only Bashir of Sudan, but even seemingly, as far as we can tell, the security services of Zimbabwe, independently of the rest of the government. That hasn't been working out so well for the Chinese. There's a second wave of thinking in China. The Chinese are realizing, simply for return on investment, that they have to care about governance too. Governance actually is better for their business. They've put a lot of money into these places, and in fact, they've got burned in a lot of places, either because they were outwitted by the locals who reneged on the deals, or because the places were so chaotic or so corrupt they actually couldn't get the returns that they were expecting. So now China, for return on investment, is looking to, for example, putting human rights standards into their internal lending to their own corporations, which is a big development there. Let me also say, it seems the Chinese are, for independent reasons, also looking to governance standards so they can be accepted as players in the world economy on the same playing field as the West. They want to show that they can do business at a higher standard also, and they can still win.
Do you see then, though, that their previous way of doing things is just moving elsewhere, moving to markets that are still sort of lower in the trajectory of going from having their equivalent of the China price of cheap goods that Westerners want to buy and the equivalent of Walmart's? So they'll get resources however they can get them?
There are places like that. And we should talk about India when it comes like that. India is also buying resources from everywhere. What we need to do is to change the world's rule. We need to change it from this terrible rule of might makes right, which is bad for everybody except for the dictators. We need to change it to the rule that the people can hold their governments accountable. The West is all set up to make that change. Like I said, we do not need authoritarian oil anymore. And actually, the West making the change would have a huge soft power impact on the rest of the world. Imagine if the United States of America stood up and said, look, who rules in other countries is none of our business, but these regimes qualify for none of our business, and we're not going to buy oil or conflict minerals from them anymore. The ideological impact of that would be great in empowering the democratic forces in other countries. But we also do need to convince the Chinese and the Indians. What we need is for China or India just to announce, I mean just announce, that at some point in the future, they will no longer be buying authoritarian oil. If it's known that at some point down the line, the oil-rich states of the Middle East will be losing their major customers, then the change agents that are waiting in those countries, outside the palaces and even inside the palaces, will get their day. If the only way for those countries to sell their resources is there for there to be a minimally accountable government, then there will be a minimally accountable government in those countries.
Staying with China just for one more moment, they're deeply insecure about the prospect of a future where they don't know where their energy is coming from. They don't believe in sort of the international pool of oil, that it'll all be there and everyone sort of takes what they need. And they want to secure their supply. And so they've done deals with Russia, with Central Asian countries. And if they can find a way of securing oil from the Middle East, it feels like that trumps or has trumped up until now any ethical considerations. Certainly the idea of, oh, this is an authoritarian government, so we can't do business with them.
And let's talk about bare national interest in the medium term. Where is China going to get its energy from? The Middle East is as bad as it's been in 50 years. It faces unprecedented bloodshed, and things look like they're going to get worse in a number of ways. The region is going through a youth bulge. The median age in Saudi right now, I think, is around 23, 24. Just the age at which youth tend to revolt. There aren't jobs for these youth. And the region from the Middle East into North Africa is exactly the region that's predicted to get hotter and drier because of climate change, at the same time as it's getting more crowded. So that arc of oil looks like it will be getting more unstable in the next 10 to 15 years. especially if we keep sending our money to whoever has the most guns. The Chinese should see that as a recipe for disaster. If they want energy security, they should work for a peaceful, gradual transition to better governance in the oil-producing countries.
You mentioned climate change. Of course, this is another issue and concern that's connected to oil. And it's interesting how terrorism, war, climate change, you know, when you think about how all of these pieces interact, and you come back to why are we so dependent on oil and on getting oil in the ways we've been getting it, if you can solve for that, for those two things, which are huge things, it starts to solve a lot of the biggest, thorniest problems we're dealing with.
That's
as,
right.
As a population on Earth.
That's so true. And, you know, we just need to do both things at once. Think of the big stories that came out of Paris last fall. One was the climate agreement, which was at least more hopeful than the Copenhagen agreement before it. And the other was a story of those terrible terrorist attacks. We need to work on both of these problems at the same time, both the climate heating up and the spread of radical views around the world. There is a plan where we could go from authoritarians to alternatives. We could tackle both problems at once and make it a win-win.
So in your book and in your arguments, you've been focusing on more ethical sourcing of oil. But are you also advocating, or are you also like weaving into your argument, moving more rapidly to renewables, moving more rapidly away from oil so that it's not even really, it's in the equation, but it's not as important a part of the equation?
Yeah, everyone can see that the best thing for both of these problems, both climate and authoritarian extremism, civil war, the best thing for both problems is getting off of fossil fuels. And we've been with fossils for a long time. They've done amazing things for our economy, and now it's time to move away from them to better energy sources. It's very plain that this is the solution. It just takes a while for humanity to get the collective will and the collective intelligence to move from what we've been doing to what we need to do now. I'm confident it will happen. If it happens more quickly, it will be better for everybody.
Well, and it does seem to be kind of hard for people to get their at least some people to get their heads around a future where oil wouldn't matter or wouldn't matter anywhere near as much. That this could be a century where oil ceases to be such a central point of contention and sort of an instigator of authoritarian regimes acting in their own interests and exploiting their populations and buying up weapons so that they can better control their populations and seizing more land so they have more oil and so on.
It's true. But we just have to imagine, and I'm so encouraged, actually, after working on these terrible issues for so long, I'm so encouraged that a better future is possible because again and again in our history, you see these momentous changes coming through. They seem impossible until they happen. I mean, imagine that I was an idealistic young person going into the marble halls of London or Paris or Amsterdam 70 years ago and saying, you know, look, this colonial system is unsustainable and it really must stop. What do you think that they would have said? Young man, surely you must see that the colonies are essential for our economy. And it did seem that way until we changed. With all of these big transformations, and of the slave trade, and of apartheid, the liberation of the colonies, it seems impossible until it happens. We will get off oil and fossil fuels, and the people who come after will look back at us and wonder why it took us so long to get our act together.
Yeah. What kind of response have you gotten from government officials you've talked to, particularly here in the United States, and also from oil executives?
The government's been very encouraging. I just came back from Capitol Hill talking with people on both sides of the aisle, both houses. People can see that what we've been doing is not working. We are spending a tremendous amount on our military keeping the world's oil supply safe. One figure I just saw is $67.5 billion a year just to secure the world's oil supply militarily. That's a huge amount of money. Why are we spending that money? People are really starting to question that. You can see that in this political season. Why are we spending all this for foreign oil when we have our own energy now? Why do we have the Fifth Fleet sitting there in the Persian Gulf? So the politicians can see just from a national security perspective, from a dollars and cents perspective, we may need to make a change. if they see that there's a way to do it peacefully by changing our own laws on our own soil so that they align with our own deepest principles, our army can stay home this time. So the politicians are listening. The problem, of course, is unlike China, our politicians are very short term. And in the short term, it's always easier to keep our alliances with our old Saudi friends as we always have. But in the long term, everyone sees we need to make a change.
Okay, so if someone's listening to this podcast who thinks, yeah, I believe in what you're talking about. I want to see this happen. What are first steps? What should citizens do? What can people do to start to move things in the right direction?
The first thing is just to find out a bit more about these issues. If you get oil on the brain, you will find oil everywhere, and you'll see oil coming through the newspapers every day. You'll see that oil has been a part of our biggest threats and crises for all of our lifetimes. I put a website up called Clean Trade. That's cleantrade.org, all one word, cleantrade.org. And at Clean Trade, you'll see a lot of things that people can do to help push the political agenda. So, for example, there's a declaration of principles that people can sign that we can take to Washington and say, look, we believe in these founding principles that the resources of every country belong to their people. We should make that our law in our own country. There's also consumer action that people can take. So in a few weeks, we'll have an index up of which are the major oil companies that buy most of their oil from authoritarian regimes. You can use that index to decide where to buy your gasoline. You know, is it Exxon or is it Shell, for example? There's some boycotts we can engage in to try to convince our Chinese friends also to stop buying authoritarian oil. One of them is called the toycotts. As you said, mostly toys are made of plastic and plastic is made of oil. So there's lots of things we can do every day to help make this change so that we're no longer in business with the men of blood abroad.
So to the extent that we need to continue to rely on oil in the 21st century, there are countries like Norway that export oil and do it in a relatively ethical way. Do you think that you can actually incentivize authoritarian governments? You know, we want to continue to export oil. Okay, we'll change our government structure. Or do you think it'll just be that those guys will be shunned from the market? They won't be able to profit anymore. And those who are already kind of doing things in a way that's more acceptable to the global community will do better.
The key difference with Norway and even US, UK is that in these countries, the oil came in after the government was accountable to the people. And when that happens, then of course the people make the government use the money for public goods like they have in Norway spectacularly.
They set up a sovereign fund so the money's available for social services.
That's exactly
and
right.
Infrastructure and things
pensions.
And pensions.
So if you're American, you can imagine that Social Security, instead of being broke, is running a surplus for 40 years in the future. That's what Norway has done with their oil money. And that's because the people were already in control of their government when the oil money came in. If that happens, then oil can be great for your country. The problem is if oil money comes in before the government is accountable to the people, because then the authoritarian gets the money and uses it to oppress the people, or even worse, armed groups get the money, and then they start a civil war. We have seen various authoritarian regimes make the transition to democracy. So think about Mexico or Indonesia. We're now seeing actually even Nigeria making that transition. Now, that's not quite as encouraging as you might think, because what's happening in all of those countries is essentially that they're running out of oil. So they become more democratic when they have lower oil revenues per capita. Once your oil revenues per capita start going down, then of course the supply of power for the authoritarian isn't there anymore and the democratic transition begins. What we need to do is to take our business away from very big oil-rich authoritarian states until they become more democratic. Now, you asked whether they would just be shunned from the world market. No. I mean, that energy is going to flow. The world needs that energy. In the Middle East, humanity's primary energy supply comes right from that region. So that energy will flow. The question is, who is it going to flow through? Is it going to flow through the men with the guns, or is it going to flow through minimally accountable governance? And what we need to do is to encourage the world only to buy from people who could possibly have the authorization of their citizens to sell off those resources.
And how are the lower oil prices at the moment coming into play in trying to achieve this goal?
It's making it easier. And the world keeps making this project easier and easier, I have to say. I mean, when I started this 10 years ago, you remember everyone was talking about peak oil. And now they don't talk about peak oil anymore. North America has enough energy now for its own needs. A lot of people think that we're going to get off authoritarian oil no matter what, even without my stuff, even without clean trade. Low oil prices also are making it easier to do this, not least because the authoritarians have less power today. It's harder for them to keep a grip on their own people, to keep their own people oppressed and in check. Even the Saudis, the biggest oil state of them all, you can see them having trouble balancing the books.
My understanding of the prices going down at the moment was that this was part of a strategy by the Saudis to try to basically drive fracking out of the market, to try to make other alternatives to oil so expensive that businesses wouldn't be able to continue, and then they could jack the prices of oil back up again.
So the big story in oil of the past 7 years has been fracking. Shale, especially in North America, where all this oil and gas is now available in the North American market. And the Saudis saw that and the drop in price that really helped to cause. And the Saudis said, we are going to keep pumping in the hopes that the price will go down so far that these frackers in America will go out of business. And to some extent, we are seeing that. Rig counts are way down, lots of bankruptcies, consolidations, but the Yankee ingenuity is stronger than the Saudis thought. And there's a real, real battle between Texas and Saudi Arabia right now. Who's going to blink first? Are the Saudis going to be able to keep their prices down at the expense possibly of their own internal security, keeping their population quiescent? Or are the Texans going to have to go out of business? It looks like the American energy industry is much more robust than the Saudis thought. And even if companies go out of business now with a low oil price, they're going to come right back and get back into business once the price goes up even a little bit.
Doesn't this also incentivize governments like ours to increase the funding of renewable energy resources, put more money into wind and solar, and say, you know, look, let's be done with it. In the past, we said it wasn't economically viable, or there were oil company interests that were lobbying. Let's just keep things the way they are. But if we're going to have this kind of yo-yo effect with the Saudis and their allies basically trying to play the market, mm-hmm. let's just get out of being part of the yo-yo effect.
It's true. And the yo-yo is very dangerous. Almost every U.S. recession since World War II has been preceded by an oil price spike. Oil is a very volatile commodity. It's more volatile than 95% of the products on the market in the United States. It goes up and down and way up and way down, and the price affects everything we buy. And it's hard for our economy to handle these shocks. And yes, in fact, we should find alternative sources of energy for sure as fast as we can. The oil companies never like this to be said, but we should also look at our oil subsidies. We, like everybody else, give special treatment to our oil companies, and that's a lot of money which is not going into the development of alternative fuels. There's a lot of things we can do in our domestic politics to change the stability in our energy supply. That's definitely things we should be looking into.
There are things we should be looking into, but I mean, the oil lobby's been pretty powerful for a very long time. Do you think it's actually going to happen?
Let me say two things about that. One, if there are any of our friends in the oil industry listening, I'm just going to ask you, how much money have you made in Iran since 1979? How is it looking for your investments in Iraq? How are you feeling about stability in Libya? What's your prognosis long-term for Algeria? How's it going in Yemen? How much money have you made in Sudan since you were chased out in the 90s? The biggest oil countries are tough for our companies because of political instability and authoritarians that are hostile to us. So simply for the oil companies, bottom line, if that's what you care about out there, you should think about governance in the countries where you want to produce. But let me also say, for the people who are not particularly in favor of the bottom line of oil companies, again, there's so many times where activists, if they have stuff ready to go, can win these David and Goliath battles, even against the oil companies. There was an example really recently, which is encouraging. One problem with oil is that it's a fantastically opaque market. The people of the country where the oil is can't find out how much money is coming into the country, how much money the government is getting. The contracts are completely opaque. It's terrible. So again, some activists, all skilled up, knew that they had a solution in terms of oil company transparency, and they got a couple of senators on their side, and the senators introduced a bill, say, in 2007, 2008, and it went nowhere because oil was very strong. But then, as with blood diamonds, the window of opportunity opened. And it happened, that window of opportunity was that terrible BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where that platform blew up and killed those people. That was a terrible incident, but the silver lining is that the oil companies were toxic in Washington that summer. They couldn't get their phone calls returned. In that summer, these two senators reintroduced their bill as part of that massive Dodd-Frank legislation. At the last minute, on the last hour of the last day, the oil transparency law was put in to the United States legal code. And the inspiring thing about that is once the Americans moved first, other countries immediately followed. So Norway, the European Union, Canada now have oil transparency laws for their companies, which are the same as ours. Now there's oil transparency required of all companies based in major Western countries. That's a tremendous advance. We didn't think that we were going to get that for years, and now it's the law.
So if you were going to answer the question related to the issues you care about here, whose century is it? What would you say?
It's the century of the peoples of the world. You can see this in the last 300 years. Individuals, networks, populations, nations are getting more power. And I mean power in terms of economic power, coercive power, more information, better linked together. With that power, they're demanding more political rights. Why do we still have authoritarians in the 21st century? How many would there be without oil and foreign aid in the largest sense? There would be some, China for sure. My strong suspicion is as the peoples of the world gain more power, they will finally everywhere come to rule their own countries, and that will make them much better able to deal with each other on a level footing.
Leif Winar, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
It's been a real pleasure, Mary Kay. Thanks so
much. Pleasure for me, too. It really is a pleasure to hear an idealist imagine a better world. The skeptic in me wonders what it's going to take to convince China's leaders and others like them that it's better for their bottom line to support countries moving toward democracy rather than authoritarian states. They've been very comfortable dealing with authoritarian states over time and less comfortable with democracy, especially if it proves contagious within China's borders. And China has done quite well for itself, rushing in to do business with authoritarian regimes while the West imposes sanctions. I doubt that's going to stop anytime soon. But the idealist in me likes the reminder that many huge changes have seemed impossible until they happened, like the end of slavery or colonialism or the Iron Curtain. We've certainly got some incentives to change our relationship with oil. Wanting a livable planet to pass on to our descendants in an age of climate change, wanting to avoid arming extremists or getting into unnecessary wars. I'm not sure authoritarianism and oppression will end because I choose to buy my gas from a place that I know screens out authoritarian oil, but it sounds like a step in the right direction. I'm in. Thanks to Leif Winar for joining me for this conversation. As he mentioned, you can learn more about his campaign against blood oil at cleantrade.org. You can also visit our webpage, pri.org/century, for a print version of this story and access to all 20 previous episodes of Whose Century Is It? You can also find us and subscribe at iTunes and on most other podcast apps, or listen on SoundCloud or Stitcher. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. If you'd like to send me a message or a suggestion for a future podcast, please do. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. We're funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. The next episode, in a couple of weeks, completing a hat trick of episodes on power. Who has it, who's abusing it, and how to rebalance it. Intrigued? Come on back and listen in.